I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
Today we talk about Abu Hamid Muhammad ibn Muhammad al-Ghazali. We're just going to call him al-Ghazali or maybe Muhammad al-Ghazali. And he was born in 448 AH, or in our common era, 1058. He was born in the Khorasan province of Persia. So we're talking about a Muslim alchemist tonight. This is interesting because in the Muslim world, alchemy was a much more kind of above board and accepted part of the philosophies or science. Al-Ghazali in particular is interesting because he lived during kind of the Islamic Golden Age. Now this, compared to Europe, this is the 11th century. So this is, you know, kind of medieval days in Europe, and I'm not going to say Dark Ages because there was definitely learning and these things going on, but in a very different manner. You know, this is the time when Arabs made huge strides forward and really had studied a lot of different kind of wisdoms and went in a lot of different directions. And Europe less so.
Europe less so, I would say, because what we call the Dark Ages is kind of a misterm used,
yeah.
Because there still was areas of enlightenment and knowledge transfer, especially within the church, of monasteries and monks writing down information by hand, by candlelight. So there still was some knowledge, but it was very select. And when we talk about the Dark Ages, we kind of really put the dark part of that in there because this whole concept of knowledge that was lost by the Roman Empire when it fell into disintegration, there was a lot of knowledge lost there, especially with
yeah.
Western Europe, but not so much in the Middle East. They decided to put a lot of focus on this, and it wasn't just for a selected group of people, even though we're talking about a selected group of people today on the show, but the knowledge was freely given.
Yeah, and in fact, some of this did trickle through back to Europe, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Al-Ghazali was Huyat al-Islam, meaning the proof of Islam, and this was given to no other scholar or personality in the Islamic history. And this kind of, you know, just to give you an idea of his status within the religion, he's also sometimes called or known as the man who saved Islam, and often referred to as the single most important Muslim after Muhammad.
Right? That's saying a lot,
so,
actually. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, tell us more about him.
Well, you know, after studying around in Persia, which was a focal point of free information at the time.
He was Persian, technically.
And this is that's an important declaration right there. Even in today's world, if you go to that area of Syria and a few other places, they say that they're Persian, they're not Arab. So
right.
those divides are still there today. One of the places after studying was around Persia. He gained a reputation as a very learned and wise man, and he made it into something called the Nezimeyas, which was the first organized center of higher learning in Iran. Which
I think of them as universities, which is probably incorrect, but definitely some, you know, think of a big library and people studying and
I think more for self knowledge. I don't know if it was for any other means, but that might be something that someone else might be a little bit more knowledgeable about than we are tonight.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, it was renowned throughout Europe. The most famous was in Baghdad, where he actually ended up. When we put this in context, we have to look at Baghdad as something that's not quite what we may know of Baghdad today in the 21st century, but the Baghdad of this era was a very golden era, full of scholars. You could walk down the streets in Baghdad and be around some of the most learned men in all of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they
literally, like,
yeah.
In all the world. Like
rubbing
was,
elbows.
Yeah,
this was the center of a lot of academia and knowledge. And what we mean by Islam's golden age is this time of science and humanities really taking a boom. Medicine, mathematics, astronomy, chemistry,
mm-hmm.
literature, so many of these type of studies and areas of understanding were really abound at this time. Under the Abbasid rule, Baghdad became a city of museums and hospitals, libraries and mosques. It really was a boom time for this area. Most of the famous Muslim scholars from the 9th and through the 13th centuries had their educational roots in Baghdad. One of the most famous centers of learning was Bayat al-Hikmah, which is the House of Wisdom. And that's something we really want to focus on here tonight, which attracted many scholars from around the world. You can think of it as a think tank.
Sure.
And yeah. it was a mixture not of just like-minded people, but a mixed bag of folks coming from different cultures and backgrounds and educational histories. So this House of Wisdom, teachers and students worked together to do several things. One, translate Greek manuscripts, preserving them for all time. We can think a lot of things that we're still that we can get our hands on today to this House of Wisdom. They also study the works of Aristotle, Plato, Hippocrates, Euclid, and Pythagoras. The House of Wisdom was home to, among others, the most famous mathematician of the time. And let's see if I can get this name right. Al-Khwarizmi, the father of algebra, where the name comes from, the book Kitlib al-Jabbar. So I think for the most part, if you were to say, I would love to go back in time to really pick the brains of some of the most amazing men together at one place, it probably would be Baghdad, which at the time was the world's richest and most intellectual city of the time, especially compared to much of Europe that was in the second was only second in size to Constantinople of the Byzantine Empire.
So big city, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this was, you know, before the Mongol invasion. Definitely like kind of the center of the world as far as like wisdom and studies. And in fact, a lot of these, the Greek things you mentioned, some of those texts would have been lost if they weren't translated to Arabic at some point. Like we wouldn't even know about them.
You know, when you look at the history books and you're taught these amazing epochs of history that were had these peaks, there's some places that I would love to be. One would be maybe the Library at Alexandria. Mm-hmm. You know, before Caesar burned it down. You know, so I would love to see what was there. And, you know, it pains me to think that what's lost. But even more recently, during the Iraq War, in the first days. Do you remember the first few days?
Yeah.
The states come in and they make a race to Baghdad. And the plan was to kind of secure the locations for safety. But what they didn't secure was the museums.
Yeah.
And so they all got looted.
That was a tragedy.
And when I heard that, I mean, of course, loss of life is paramount. I mean, that's what you're kind of worried about in a war action. But the second thing to me was the loss of some of those things that might make it to the black market, stuff that might be lost to history
This is the cradle of civilization, right? So that's a shame.
It is a shame. But I think this, going back to what I was saying, I think that this would be one of those places and times that I would love to go back and experience.
One of the people you might meet there was Al-Ghazali, right? So he was studying in Baghdad. And at this point, you know, you mentioned he had quite a reputation. And he was known far and wide. He even had a reputation in Europe. I mean, that's how well-known he was. But in any case, in 1095, he had a spiritual crisis. So he left Baghdad. He kind of said that he was going on a pilgrimage to Mecca, which was a good excuse to leave. But in truth, he just kind of, he abandoned his career and he didn't want to do that anymore. He wanted a change of pace. So he made arrangements for his family and disposed of his wealth, which is interesting, and just adopted a really ascetic lifestyle, kind of drifted around. He went to Damascus, Jerusalem. Eventually, he did in fact visit Medina and Mecca in 1096, so, you know, basically the next year. And he returned to Tus in Persia, which was his birth town, and he spent the next several years there. So eventually, here's this great wise man, basically just living an ascetic life. So he did get some pressure to return to a Nizamiya in Nishapur 10 years later. So after 10 years of kind of living this solitary lifestyle. But at this point, he knew that some of his teachings were a little unorthodox, and we'll talk about, you know, his philosophy and things later. But he knew that returning to this kind of professorship style life would get him into trouble. He went back to Tus, and then he declined an invitation to Baghdad in 1110, and he died the next year. Now, to talk about some of the things he did, kind of, he had an opinion on many, many things, and he was certainly a scholar. One thing that's important is Islam, kind of as a religion or as a philosophy, took a turn at this point, because he actually refuted Neoplatonism so thoroughly that it never actually recovered in the Muslim world. Now I'm gonna clarify that statement a little bit, because it's obviously thought that he read Aristotle, argued against it, and refuted it. But that's a simplistic way to look at it. So actually, what he did was he argued and analyzed Aristotle so well that I wouldn't say he refuted it outright, but he was able. Some parts he just said, you know, this goes against Islam, and we need to abandon it. And other parts, he modified Aristotle and you know, kind of Platonic thinking, and was actually able to move on, like to build upon it, you know, within the Muslim faith.
Well, you know, I think that it also might add to the reasons that Greece and anything that came from Greece was considered Western in their mindset, and I think mm-hmm. that it probably didn't jive well with anything that they were trying to center their yeah. society around. I mean, that goes back a long
but
way.
But that was him because yeah. before this, they a lot of this Aristotle, same as in the West. You would think that, you know, Aristotle was a pagan. He was, you know, pre-Catholic, but the Catholics really embraced him, you know, 100%, you know, more or less. And Islam was the same way until him.
Another point I think I want to make, though, is that history runs deep in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Even today, people will tell you things that happen, you know, as if they happened yesterday, that happened several hundred years ago, if not longer, as a source of national pride. And they never really forgot the battles of the Peloponnese, you know, when you had Xerxes and the Peloponnese states and all the things that went on with that. They never really forgave Alexander the Great. All right, he was considered
to this day yeah.
he was considered a conquering genius in the West, but that's not how it felt.
But in the East, it's different. Yeah,
exactly. So I think that. I'm taking a little bit of a leap here without this kind of knowledge set, but I would like to say that might have colored some of his anti-Plato thinkings, that nothing good really should come from or be attributed to true knowledge from the Greek area. So,
you know, because they translated a lot of the Greek stuff that we have today. If it wasn't for these Muslims translating it, we wouldn't even know about some of the stuff. So it is interesting. Like they took it seriously. Like they studied it, translated it, you know, and then the philosophers gave it weight and said, okay, well, this is true, this is not true, or and in Al-Ghazali's case, well, said, you know, this kind of goes against our faith, or this is okay, we can build on it, you know.
So it sounds really very similar to the Catholic Church at the time, though, too. I mean, cherry picking things here and there to say what would fit into their belief system, especially when it comes to science.
Yeah, one of his main works is called the Incoherence, which is the short form of the title, but it really analyzed Aristotle and Plato. The book took aim at the Falasifa, which is kind of an Islamic group of philosophers from the 8th through 11th centuries, through this time. And one really notable person is Avicenna, who had an influence on Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas. And we did an episode on Albertus Magnus, and Albertus Magnus reviewed every part of Aristotle. Aristotelian writing, okay? And a lot of this he got from Arabic, so not straight from Greek, but, you know, so...
Okay, I see the connection.
And,
all right.
Yeah, and what's interesting is, like, Thomas Aquinas, Al-Ghazali was actually an influence of Thomas Aquinas's. So we're talking right about that time. They were, you know, they were almost contemporaries. Of course, they never met each other, you know, 1,000 miles apart. But Thomas Aquinas, so Al-Ghazali did influence Thomas Aquinas, but Thomas Aquinas took a much more pro-Aristotle viewpoint. Okay, so they're looking at the same text and partially seeing different things. So it is very interesting how they, you know, look at the same source material and go in different directions. So Avicenna was one of these Falasifa that he was arguing against because they were too pro-Aristotle or Plato. Al-Farabi was another one of these. So he labeled part of these Aristotelian Socrates and Greek writers as kind of corruptors of the Islamic faith. On the contrary, Al-Ghazali argued that everything is directly caused by God. And this brings us to one of his main things he argued for or promoted, which was Sufism.
And Sufism, to give it our folks, our listeners, an idea about what that is, it's defined by the its adherence as the inner mystical dimension of Islam. Mm-hmm. So kind of like the inside game, if you will, of thought of Islam and its inner workings. Sufis consider themselves as the original true proponents of this pure original form of Islam. So I don't know if I want to really connect them to maybe the Gnostic kind of ideas of the Christian faith, a feeling that they were the true bearers of the seed of God's wisdom. But we're getting pretty close to that. It's very, very pure. They were very strong adherents of the principle of tolerance, peace, and against any forms of violence. So if you can imagine, this was a rough time for maybe this group, because at this time, the move of Islam was spread not all the time by peace. It was also spread by the tip of a sword, through pushing in through Europe and other areas as well. So I don't know if this was really kind of something that they flowed with, but the Sufis were considered a very peaceful branch of Islam at the time.
I think that it goes to show how important Al-Ghazali was, because Sufis is a, listeners, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's a subset of Sunnis, and Sunnis had a much weaker position within the Muslim world before Al-Ghazali. So just the fact that he argued for Sunnis, and you know, this Sufis was one of these Sufis, as you mentioned, after his time, Sunnis had a much greater influence in the Muslim world, and still do today. So yeah, he really kind of set Islam on a new course, especially this philosophical thinking. One thing that's very important that he did was he split the scientific study, right? So before, everything was just considered philosophy, even, you know, any kind of science, if you're talking about medicine, astronomy, or whatever. And a lot of people saw this as you're either Muslim or you are a philosopher. So if you believe in some parts of philosophy that you can just prove, an eclipse happens and you can explain why that happens mathematically or optically or whatever, that's obviously true. But then they thought, well, if you believe in some parts of this philosophy, if you're a philosopher, then you believe in all of it. So you also believe in jinn and weird mystical occult beliefs. So one thing that he did was he split it. So he said not all philosophy is philosophy, just like not all science is science. You know, so he wrote on theology, Sufism, as you mentioned, even justice, like jurisprudence and law and some things. And so he split, you know, he said, like, you know, medicine is one thing. Philosophy, okay, that's, you know, that might be something else. Astronomy is another thing. It's not the same thing. They're not necessarily related. So they don't have these mystical things in common.
Travis, do you think that if you were to actually sit down with Al-Ghazali, that you could have a conversation that wouldn't be too much over your head?
Well, my Persian really sucks.
I think if you took away the language barrier,
okay.
let's just say that if we're time traveling at this point, I think we could take away the language barrier. All right, but if you were to sit down and just talk with him, do you think he would give you a sense of from a common man's knowledge, or do you think it would be more of a very ethereal, just maybe a little bit too over someone's head because you didn't have the same knowledge base?
Yeah.
That might be a hard question to answer.
Actually, I think with any of these people that I've read about and studied, we come from very different places. So like our assumptions of what's fact and what's not fact is very different. So I think that he was a very rational, you know, being. I mean, he could read something and analyze it like in a very intelligent way, but his assumptions about what's real and what's not real might be very different.
It sounds to me he might be a little bit measured as well, in the sense that he was caught, like a lot of our other focal points in science when we talk about alchemy.
Was he a wise man? Yes.
Well, absolutely.
I be able to learn from him? Yes. But I might kind of take, you know, I might kind of wink, wink, and nod, nod at a couple of things.
Maybe he would have kept one foot in the Islamic faith and been stubborn, saying, hey, I'm not going to go against that, which is in a lot of ways very admirable, but also somewhat curtailing his other part of his belief system with the other foot in the area of science, of proof and measurement. And as we know, faith sometimes is not proof and measurement. It's just a feeling.
Yeah, some of the things that I read was, even though while he differed from his predecessors in trying to be even more kind of scientific and fact-based, and, you know, to the point of pushing Aristotle aside, which Aristotle was, like, you know, the fact-based person at the time. But some of the things I've read is still very, let's say, theological, which is, you know, it's neither here nor there. There's still theologians alive today, but again, coming from a very different viewpoint from where I am. Now, he did a lot of interesting things and had a lot of interesting ideas. For the sake of this podcast, what I want to talk about is a very famous book he wrote, which is...
That would be Kimiyayi Sa'adat, which is translated from Persian into English as The Alchemy of Happiness. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about alchemy, one thing that we all kind of think about, at least in Western mind thought, and alchemy in history, is metallurgy. Mm-hmm. You know, changing something into something precious, gold, from something that's not precious. I want you to take that thought out of your head, except for the word precious. Mm-hmm. Okay? So it has nothing to do with metallurgy as we would know it later in the Middle Ages in Europe. But this thought had to do with this book mentions the ways to worship in Islam, and at the end, receiving happiness, which includes the afterlife. Mm-hmm. This book is a great example of alchemy in the sense that it's talking about transmutation of the soul in preparation for life eternal. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about this type of alchemy, it's spiritual alchemy.
Yep.
Chemia, which is another word for alchemy, is where it comes from,
yep.
Is applied in a mystical science, and it's been studied for many, many centuries. In essence, chemia really represents the complete conception of the universe, and if you can wrap this around your head, the relations between earthly beings and the cosmos. Mm-hmm. So it is a really kind of a...
It's kind of this as above, so below thing again.
Like I think so. Something, is this, if this sounds familiar, it is, but it's just in a different place and a different time, with a different sort of mentality. The religious philosophers of this era and this location emphasize the importance of religion in this discipline. So you cannot separate this type of study from religion. It has to be part and parcel of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Once you make that connection, I think you're really going to have a great hold on this era, especially with Ghazali and what he was dealing with, because this is really important to understand this. This is the noblest of all occult sciences. More so than astrology, more so than the magic, more so than the things that we think of occult in the Middle Ages.
Which is different than Europe, I would say. Like Europe, this was next to charlatanism, or
you know, yeah.
Not always, but
there were some guys that would consider this, you know, a shell game. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe in Europe. So this was very, very serious. And Ghazali himself believed that everything on earth is a manifestation of God's spirit. Thus, everything belongs to chemia. So everything belongs to alchemy in mm-hmm. this sense.
Yeah. All right.
So
there you go.
Please don't get it confused. When we talk about alchemy, it's a little bit of a different spin here.
To kind of give you one of the quotes from the books that I think kind of embodies this whole book very well is so from The Alchemy of Happiness, God has sent on earth 124,000 prophets to teach men the prescription of this alchemy and how to purify their hearts from baser qualities in the crucible of abstinence. This alchemy may be briefly described as turning away from the world, and its constituents are four: knowledge of self, knowledge of God, knowledge of this world as it really is, knowledge of the next world as it really is. So if you can say that whole paragraph is a definition of alchemy as far as he understood it. So again, like you said, transmutating your soul for the afterlife, like purifying your soul. I mean, we definitely know the concept from other kind of religious sounding things. But so this was in the Muslim world, this kind of purification of your soul is one and the same with alchemy, really. Now, he had, I mentioned or hinted a few times that he had a huge influence in Europe. So the place where he studied in Baghdad was actually known throughout Europe, like you mentioned. And he had an influence on Thomas Aquinas. I mentioned that they went in very different directions in some ways, especially regarding Aristotle. And again, when Albertus Magnus commented on a lot of this Aristotelian stuff, then a lot of this things would have came from Arabic. So, I mean, it's, you know, he had a huge influence here. So Thomas Aquinas obviously incorporated Aristotle much more than Al-Ghazali did. But in any case, we'll leave you with one more quote from Al-Ghazali.
It's one of my favorite quotes from him, which is actually, "Knowledge exists potentially in the human soul like the seed in the soil." So it is very universal. It's mm-hmm. it's not something for the elite. It's potentially something that can grow in any one of us, that knowledge base. And I think that how it grows and how much it grows is actually up to that person. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a neat thought. Kind of like that.
Yeah. Well, if you want to read a little bit more about Al-Ghazali, feel free to check out my website at historyofalchemy.com. And there'll be him and many other alchemists and other alchemical type of things there.
Is that actually the word? Alchemical?
It is now. It is now. it's chemicals from Al. Nice. And by all means, email us with if you have any feedback, kind of pronunciation corrections or just corrections about...
You might get a lot of emails on from this Tonight Show.
Yeah. I'm going a little bit out of my expertise talking about an Arabic or Persian alchemist, but this was definitely fun to research. I definitely learned a lot. But in any case, send us your thoughts at podcast@historyofalchemy.com and find us on... under Facebook, under History of Alchemy Podcast. We'd love to hear from you.
And also you can take a listen to our sister podcast, Bohemican Podcast at bohemican.com. I'd love to have you come by and take a look at everything that I'm doing here in Bohemia and the wonderful things that I learn about every day and as an expat living in the Czech Republic. So please come by and take a look at that at bohemican.com. We'll be back every 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening.
Yeah, thanks.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.